the first chapter of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe, Reb Shneur Zalman of Wadi, introduces us to the first of the two souls that every person has, whether he's righteous or sinful. The first soul being the animal soul, the natural soul, or the human soul. This human soul is mortal, is devoted to its self-preservation, and produces all the negative traits such as anger and arrogance, boasting and scoffing, laziness and depression, and passion and desires. It also produces two good qualities, compassion and generosity, in most people, while in some people the soul produces only the negative. It doesn't have instinctive, inborn good qualities and acquires them only through conviction, by believing and discovering that being good is good for you. And so it's motivated, again, by self-preservation rather than the goodness that places other people's needs before your own. That's the human soul. In chapter 2, the Rebbe tells us about the second soul. And it's called the second soul because it settles into the person at a later date, not at birth. The first soul is there from the moment the child starts to exist. The child wants to eat, wants to be comfortable, wants to be taken care of. Self-preservation has already set in. The second soul settles into the body a bit later in life, for a boy at the age of 13 and for a girl at the age of 12. And that's why that is considered the age of majority, when a boy and girl become responsible for their own mitzvahs or for their own sins, because then the godly soul is capable of counteracting the demands and the habits of the animal soul. So now the person really does have freedom of choice and can choose to do right over wrong, and is therefore now responsible for their own choices. So it's called the second soul. This second soul is what makes a Jew Jewish. There are times when Jew and non-Jew feel a kindred spirit, and that's because their human souls are compatible and similar. But what makes the Jew Jewish? What makes the Jew Jewish is this little piece of God from above, and the Alter Rebbe uses the word mima'al, from above, quoting from the Torah. But older Hasidim have passed on the tradition that when the Rebbe used the word mima'al, he was really referring to the mystical origins of this godly soul, and that is hinted at by the word mima'al, because the Hebrew word al means above. Me'al means from above the above. Mima'al would mean three stages removed, above what is above the above. And that's because the godly soul, unlike creation, which comes from God's speech, God said, let there be, and there was, this godly soul comes from the level of thought within God, and not the thought that precedes speech, but the inner thought that is the inner conviction. So the godly soul comes al, me'al, mima'al, from the inner thought of God, as he will explain in this chapter. In the story of creation, we are told that God formed a human being and then breathed into him a living soul. Everything else in creation, God said, and there was. God said, let us make man, and so man was made. But the soul was breathed into his nostrils. What is the Torah, what is the text trying to tell us? It's saying that there is a soul that was not created through speech. God didn't say, let there be a soul. God breathed the soul into the human being. The difference between saying and breathing is that when you say, you use your breath. When you speak, you use breath. But as we all know, people can talk for a long time without stopping, without growing tired. Because the breath that we use in speaking is the external breath. It's not the breath of life. But try blowing up a balloon. Now here you're using your inner breath, not just more breath, but a different quality of breath, a breath that comes from a deeper place within us. It's the breath of life, and that's why one or two balloons and you're exhausted, if you're in good shape. Breathing the soul into the human being implies that deeper breath, the breath that is the breath of life, a breath that you cannot give away easily because it is so essential to yourself. So when we say that the second soul is a little piece of God, that's why the Torah describes it as God breathing a little piece of himself into the nostrils of Adam, of Adam. Now, this godly soul, which is equal in the tzaddik and the rasha, in the most righteous as well as the most sinful, doesn't express itself, doesn't influence the body and the person in whom it resides to the same degree, obviously. In the righteous person, the godly soul calls all the shots. It dictates everything. It is the mover and the shaker behind all activity of the body and the human being. In other people, in non-tzaddikim, the godly soul is present, but doesn't have that kind of an effect. Doesn't have that kind of influence. And that's why the person, although he has a godly soul, is not a tzaddik. Now, if all souls originate mima'al, from this higher place in God, it's a piece of God, how is it that not all people who have the soul are on the same level of godliness? We know, for example, that the soul of Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov were far greater souls than, let's say, the souls of our generation. We know that the soul of Moses was much greater than the soul of Joshua. If they all come from within God, why are they different? Why do they differ? And for this, the Rebbe gives us the analogy that the fetus developing in the womb develops many different limbs, many different organs, many different parts. There is the brain of the fetus and the stuff that brain is made of. And then there are the toenails of the fetus and the stuff that toenails are made of. Now we know that all of the fetus originates in one place, in the brain of the mother and father. Now you would expect that the fetus would turn out to be all brain stuff because it comes from the brain of the parent. And yet, the fetus develops not only a brain, but also other limbs, including even the toenails. Now, as we observe a fetus in the process of developing and the process of being born, there really is no distinction between the toenail and the brain. It is all part of that miracle of birth. The miracle of life. We recognize and we experience every part of that fetus as the procreative potential of the parents. Now, when the child is born and is no longer developing inside the mother and it has an existence and a life of its own, even then, there is still a connection. There is still a oneness between the child and the father and mother, including even the toenails of the child. But now the connection is not as obvious, not as visible, not as understandable. In a similar fashion, all souls come from heaven. All godly souls are a piece of God. But as they develop through the process of birth, coming down from the heaven of heavens down to earth and so on, every soul takes on a different look, a different character, but it's all the same miracle of birth, even if it doesn't express itself in the same way. With this we will understand a very important fundamental teaching in Torah. The Torah says, after giving us all the commandments, telling us all 613 mitzvahs, then the Torah says that on top of it all, in addition to it all, you should cleave to God. And the Talmud asks, the Gemara asks, how do you cleave to God? If not through doing mitzvahs, and we're already doing the mitzvahs, what else can one do to cleave to God? The Gemara's answer is, be devoted, be loyal to the teachings of a tzaddik, of a Talmud Chacham, and that will be considered as if you are cleaving to God. The Rebbe wants further explanation. The Torah says cleave to God. The Gemara asks, how can you cleave to God? And then says, cleave to the tzaddik, and it's as if you cleave to God, which is really begging the question. That is not an answer. The Torah says to cleave to God. So how can the Gemara come along and say, well, we can't cleave to God, we'll do something almost as good. We'll cleave to the tzaddik. So the Rebbe sees in this a much deeper message. A tzaddik has a godly soul just the same as the non-tzaddik. The difference is that in the tzaddik, the godly soul has not changed, has not undergone any transformation of look, of appearance, of feeling. In other words, like in the analogy, the tzaddik is like the brain of the child that has remained exactly the same as the brain of the parent from which it comes. Whereas the toenail of the child, also coming from the brain of the parent, also part of that miracle of procreation, also part of the miracle of birth, but it took on another look. It took on another quality. It took on other properties. But it is just as real in its connection to the father and the mother as is the brain. So the soul of the non-tzaddik that has taken on a different look, like the toenails of the fetus, is still very much, remains very much a piece of God from above. That can't change. That can't be undone. But it doesn't feel like, it doesn't experience itself like a piece of God from above. So what happens? To cleave to God would mean that your soul should be comfortable with God like a bosom buddy. And if you don't feel that way, then cleave to a tzaddik. And what will happen when you cleave to a tzaddik? What will happen when you place your loyalty and your devotion into the teachings and instructions of a tzaddik? You will cleave to God. Because what the tzaddik will do is put you in touch with the true nature of your soul, and your soul does cleave to God, only you didn't know it. So by cleaving to the tzaddik, you're not finding a substitute, you're not doing what's second best, you're actually finding your way to cleaving to God through the tzaddik. Because the tzaddik is like the child who has not become estranged from its parents, the child who is estranged can regain his relationship with his parents through the child, through the sibling, that never strayed and was never alienated from the parent. But in the end, both souls are back to its original primal connection to God, not just to each other. Now, the Rebbe quotes from the Zohar, where the Zohar says that the quality of a child's soul depends entirely on the sanctification, on the state of mind and heart of the parents during the intimacy that produces this child. So if the parents are sanctifying themselves, are in a holy mood, in a holy frame of mind, then the soul of the child born from that union will be holy and sensitive. And if the parents are coarse or vulgar, then the soul of the child will also be coarse and vulgar. Now this seems to contradict what we've just finished saying. Every godly soul is a piece of God, even if it's the toenail rather than the brain. It is no less a part of God or a piece of God than the highest soul. So the souls of our generation being the footsteps of Moshiach, because comparing our souls to the souls of the patriarchs, their souls were like brains and heads, our souls are like feet, the footsteps of Moshiach. Even so, our souls as the feet, foot souls, are no less divine, no less godly than the head souls of the patriarchs. How then can the Zohar say that the quality of the soul is determined by the parents? The Rebbe tells us that every soul is born with a garment, which means that all the qualities that a soul has are, the qualities are personal, internal, and not given to expression. A soul is a very private entity. How does it express itself? How do the qualities of the soul come out from the soul into the mind, into the heart, into the body, into the behavior of the body? All of that comes through a garment. Just as a person wears a garment with which to appear in public. So when you're going out into the public, you put on a garment which tells the public something about yourself. You wear a uniform, so to speak. You wear this kind of a dress, people know that you're all business and no nonsense. You wear another kind of a dress or outfit or uniform, and people know that you're fun and spontaneous and so on. So the quality of the personality is visible to the outside by its garments. A soul has to have a garment with which to relate to the body. So if the soul is going to influence the body, it's got to do so through its garment, primarily the garment of thought. Thought takes the inner workings of the soul into the conscious state. Prior to thought, the soul is experiencing many things, but you don't know it. Thought is the first step where the activities internal to the soul become knowable, express themselves to the conscious mind. Now that garment is determined by the quality of the frame of mind of the parents at the time of conception. If the parents sanctify themselves, then this child will be born with a garment that is sensitive, that is delicate, that is responsive. If the parents are not sanctifying themselves at the time of conception, if they're being vulgar or crude or whatever, then the garment will be a crude garment, which means that the soul will have a harder time expressing its godly instincts through this garment, through this thought process, to the conscious mind. And so we see in children, we see that some children have a natural, effortless response to everything good and noble and moral and godly, to every mitzvah. You tell a child that at three years old, you tell a little boy, you have to wear your kippah, you have to have this yarmulke on your head, and the child takes to it naturally, effortlessly, painlessly, and will be upset every time the yarmulke falls off his head. Wants to sleep with it, doesn't want to lose the yarmulke. And then you have other kids, good kids, but when you tell him that he has to wear a yarmulke, he's annoyed by it. It'll take a long time before the child is comfortable and natural with his yarmulke. And that's because the garment through which his soul expresses itself to his behavior, to his thinking, and to his feelings, the garment is not as sensitive, not as delicate, not as responsive. It's a coarse garment, and it'll take a while for the godliness to filter through that garment and become comfortable to the body, to the mind, to the habits and behavior of this child. And we see it in adults as well. There are some people who somehow miraculously, mysteriously show up every time something good is happening. They're part of it. They're there. I don't know, how do they find out about this? How do they hear it? They show up almost magnetically. They're drawn to everything good, everything positive. And then, unfortunately, there are people who have the opposite tendency, the opposite magnetic pull. Wherever there's trouble, wherever something is wrong, they're involved somehow. They get there somehow. And that's not because of a difference in soul. Their souls are pure and godly and a piece of God from above, but the garment is not as cooperative. The garment is not as readily influenced and does not readily facilitate the expression of the soul's desires, of the soul's interests, through to the mind and to the conscious thinking. The soul itself, however, is always a divine product, a piece of God from above. And that is not dependent on the quality of the parent's thinking or behavior. In fact, we find often that the godliest of souls, the most noble, the most exalted of souls, are at times born to parents who are the most, the lowest, the coarsest, the most callous of people. The exact opposite of the soul of their child. And the reason for that is given in Kabbalah, in the writings of the Ari, that in the balance of good and evil in the world, in the balance of earthiness versus godliness in the world, which allows us to have freedom of choice, every time a great soul is going to be introduced into the world, the balance is threatened. With this kind of greatness, with this kind of godliness present in the world, how will we still have the freedom to be able to choose between good and bad when the good will be so obvious and so strong? And so to maintain the balance, the goodness, the holiness, the godliness of these great souls slip into the world unnoticed because they are surrounded by unholiness, by things that are unremarkable, so that their entry into the world doesn't rock the balance of good and evil, because nobody notices this greatness coming into the world. And so we find that Avraham was born into this world to a father who was the idol maker, the wholesale idol producer of his generation. Now, why would that be? Because the godliness can't overwhelm the world. It can't disrupt the balance. It has to slip in quietly without causing too many ripples. And that comes about when the godliest of souls is born to a person who conceals all of that godliness with the idolatry and with the unholiness that surrounds him. And that's why unholiness is often called the shell, the klipa. In Kabbalah, evil, unholiness, is called klipa, the husk or the shell. Just as the shell hides the fruit that is within it, the klipa, the unholiness, hides the godliness that is within it. So it's one of the functions of evil is to keep a balance of the godly and the human to where we can choose either one of them with equal ease. That's the job of the evil, to make the godly less remarkable, less overwhelming than it would be if it wasn't concealed by this shell, by this husk that covers the fruit and that hides what's inside it. And so sometimes a great soul will be born necessarily to the least impressive parents so that the presence of this greatness won't be immediately appreciated. And perhaps that's what we mean by hidden saints or hidden tzaddikim. We're told that there are, in every generation, there are at least 36 hidden tzaddikim. Why do they have to be hidden? Not out of humility, not out of secrecy. They have to be hidden more in the sense of filtered, that their godliness, the holiness of their presence, has to filter into the world slowly, gradually, without causing too many ripples. So the hidden means that behind their simple facade, there is a much greater godliness than we see. And that's because to see it all would be unfair in this balance of good and evil. It would make the world good by divine intervention rather than by its own free choice. So every Jew has a godly soul that makes him Jewish. Godly in the sense that it is a piece of God, not a created being, not something God said and there was, but something God breathes of himself into the soul or into the nostrils of Adam. And this soul, unlike the natural soul, is not afraid of its mortality, is not busy preserving itself, defending itself, protecting itself, and surviving, and wants nothing other than what God wants. It is a piece of God, mima'al, coming from the inner thought, from the inner convictions of God, and is therefore indestructible, cannot be lost and cannot be transformed. It cannot lose its divinity, it can't lose its godliness. And that's why a Jew, even the Jew who consciously chooses not to be a Jew, to convert to some other religion, and does convert, yet his soul remains Jewish, the person remains Jewish, and if it's a woman, the children will be born Jewish, because the godly soul is godly not by option, not by choice, not by conviction, but simply by its very nature.